the last 6 weeks, we've gone through the subject of Buddhist morality. So I went through how that differs from conventional notions of morality. And then we went into why we have to take the precepts, what are the benefits of taking the precepts. And then we started going through each of the five precepts in detail, looking at what are the factors that constitute a violation, and what are the exceptions involved in each precept. And so we've come to the final talk today, and I'd like to thank Shifu, Venerable Guan, for giving me an opportunity to finish off this series. And as the Venerable mentioned, in Buddhism we have the three pillars of the Buddhist practice, which is sila, samadhi, and prajna. And all three of these pillars reinforce one another. So you cannot have one without the other. And we start with the Buddhist practice by practicing Buddhist morality, because it's Buddhist morality that allows us to address the crudest defilements of our body, speech, and mind. And so it's important for us to understand what the precepts are and why we need to take them, because that is the way that we enter to the path of liberation from our sufferings. And so I won't go into any of the details relating to why you have to take the precepts. I discussed that in the very first few sessions. But if any of you are interested in listening to the previous lectures, you can let us know and we can send you a link to the YouTube video. So today I'd like to cover the fourth and the fifth precept. So that's abstaining from false speech and abstaining from taking alcohol or intoxicants. Now, for people who are here for the first time, haven't listened to this series yet, what I'm about to go over will seem quite technical and dry. The first few sessions were more general in nature and perhaps is more amenable for first-time listeners on this subject. So if you could bear with us over the next half hour, I'd just like to finish this off so that we can wrap up the series. Now, so of all the five precepts, really the easiest ones to violate are stealing and false speech. Now, stealing is very easy to violate because we often have to handle money. We have to deal with all sorts of transactions and exchanges involving money with people on a daily basis. And so it can be very easy for us to break that precept. We know from our past discussion that stealing can come in different forms. It can come through your own effort. It can come through teaching others to steal. It can also come through evading taxes, taking things in trust, misusing other people's identity. And so because stealing can come in so many different forms, and many of these forms are very subtle in nature. For example, borrowing someone's identity to get some sort of benefit, like borrowing someone's membership card to get a discount, or not paying taxes or custom duties when they're due, when you're at the airport crossing the customs area and you fail to report the item that should have a customs duty payable on it. These very subtle forms of stealing can make it very difficult for us to uphold that precept well. Now, the same goes with this fourth precept, which is abstaining from false speech. It doesn't take much planning or effort to commit false speech in most situations. But the effects that false speech can have can be very destructive, and it can lead to a lot of suffering for ourselves and for other people. And as we'll see, false speech does not only refer to lying, but it also refers to other forms of harmful speech, like cursing, double-tongued speech, insincere speech, gossiping, slandering. The thing about false speech is that we're always constantly in communication with people. We have to use language and speech to interact with people. And living with other people requires us to be social to a certain extent. And so when our minds are dominated by strong negative emotions like desire, hatred, and ignorance, then it can be very difficult at times to refrain from committing false speech, harmful speech, that can cause harm to the other person. And on top of that, sometimes the environment that we're in can make it very difficult for us to practice responsible speech. For example, depending on the type of work you do, dishonest and insincere speech may even be encouraged in your work environment. For example, if you're working in finance or in the corporate world, you'll know that dishonest speech, malicious speech, using foul language can often be encouraged in those types of work environments. And sometimes if you don't commit the kind of speech, you might actually get in trouble with your boss, or at least it might make it very difficult for you to fit in into your company culture and work environment. So we can see that society and our work can make it very difficult for us to uphold these precepts, and it places a lot of pressure on us at times to commit all sorts of bad karma. But ultimately, we decide our own destiny. And so we sow the causes for our own happiness or suffering. And so if we want to sow the causes that lead to our happiness, then we have to uphold the precepts, because that's what the law of causality tells us. The whole idea of Buddhist morality is centered around this law of causality, that goodness leads to happiness and evil leads to suffering. It's very simple. Even a 3-year-old may understand this concept, but even an 80-year-old veteran who has spent his entire life trying to practice it may not be able to uphold it well. And so, happiness comes from sowing the right causes, and we do so by first following the precepts. So let's take a look at this fourth precept. The definition that I have up there is, false speech is what one says is not consistent with what one knows, untruthful and dishonest speech, speech intended to mislead another. So what false speech is what you say does not reflect the actual situation as you know it. Now the most important criterion for violating this precept is having the intention to deceive or mislead another person. So sometimes we can say certain things that don't reflect the actual situation, but we don't have the intention to mislead or deceive the other person. We may actually believe that what we're saying is genuinely the truth, but because of our lack of wisdom, because of our lack of experience, or because of certain changing variables, what we say is not the truth. And so in those circumstances, then that would not be a violation of this precept, because the intention to mislead was not there. And so false speech can be grouped into 3 main categories. The first is what I call transcendental false speech, and that's a major offense. The second is mundane false speech, which carries with it a minor offense. And the third is convenient false speech. And I'll discuss all 3 of them in detail, but let's start off with the first, which is transcendental false speech. Now, this refers to making false claims about achieving some supernormal spiritual state, like attaining enlightenment, arahatship, the fourth jhana, or some other deep meditative state. And it also includes making false claims about achieving supernormal abilities, like seeing heavenly devas and spirits, seeing past and future lives, reading other people's minds. And so when one is making these claims, usually what they're looking for is some sort of benefit from the other person. It might be for material possessions. It might be for reverence or respect from that person. Or that person might want a group of disciples to follow him and attend to his own personal needs. But regardless of the motive, if there is an intention to mislead the other person into thinking that you have achieved some supernormal spiritual state when you have not, then that is violating what we call a transcendental false speech. Now, transcendental false speech is a very major offense, and it carries with it some very serious retributions, which I'll talk about a bit later. But first, we should understand why it is a major offense. Now, when the Buddha first began expounding on his teachings after his enlightenment, his disciples placed the Buddha as the highest authority. So whatever the Buddha said or did, they would follow or do. And there wasn't any dispute as to what the Buddha taught. His words that he spoke were like gold, and his followers faithfully followed by them and lived by them in their practice. The Buddha was the only teacher that they had, and they relied on him exclusively for all the teachings. But once the Buddha passed away and entered into parinirvana, there wasn't anyone to rely on anymore for the teachings. No one was there to guide them on the path. So the Buddha said that after his passing, his disciples should follow his teachings. The Buddha's teachings, or what we call Dharma, should be their teacher. And so since the Buddha's passing, almost 2,600 years ago, all Buddhist followers and practitioners have relied on the teachings, the Dharma, as the definitive source for all the teachings that the Buddha left behind. And so the problem is, when someone makes a false claim to have achieved a supernormal spiritual state, like enlightenment or arahatship, what they're doing is they're really disrupting the natural order of Buddhist authority. So the authority, as the Buddha had instructed, should be the Dharma only, the teachings that he left behind, and not any one individual who has claimed to achieve enlightenment. So someone who has made a false claim is essentially trying to put themselves above the Dharma. And by doing that, they're misleading others to think that their enlightenment entitles them to be placed above the teachings, that they should be the ones to be followed and respected, and that their own personal teachings should be followed rather than the teachings that were left behind by the Buddha. So then, that leads to the next question, why is that such a serious offense? Well, by falsely claiming to have achieved an enlightened state, what you're doing is you're essentially robbing that person of the opportunity to practice the genuine teachings that were left behind by the Buddha. And so whatever progress that person has made on the path to seeking liberation from their suffering, you have obstructed, because that person has now been led to believe that they should follow your teachings instead of the genuine teachings of the Buddha. And so it's a very serious offense, because what you're doing is you're blocking that person's path to seeking true liberation from their sufferings by making that false claim. And so it carries with it some very serious retributions, which I'll talk about a bit later. But before we get into that, let's take a look at some of the factors. So with all the precepts, as you know, there are a number of factors involved, and all factors have to be present in order to constitute a full violation of that major precept. And so for this transcendental false speech, we have a number of factors. We have 9 in total. And all of them have to be present in order to constitute a full violation. So the first is object. The object has to be a human being who is capable of understanding. So if you say it to an animal, or if you say it to a child who is not able to understand what you're saying, then that factor is not fulfilled. It has to be someone who has the mental capacity to understand what you're saying. The second is the perception of the object. So not only does the object have to be a human being, you have to perceive it to be a human being as well. The third is false claim. So what you're claiming is different from the actual reality of things. And the fourth is perception of claim, perceiving that claim to be false. So say, out of excessive arrogance, you really do think that you've achieved some supernormal spiritual state, and you're generally convinced that you have achieved that state, but you obviously haven't, then because you did not perceive that claim to be false at the time you said it, then that would not fulfill this factor. And so that would not be a major violation. The intention. So obviously with every precept, one of the most important factors is the intention. So you should ask yourself, if you had the intention to mislead or deceive the other person when you made that claim. The nature of the speech. So it has to be in regards to you obtaining some sort of higher spiritual state. I'll go into the other form of false speech, which is mundane false speech, which is different from this, because mundane false speech does not cover any of the unworldly achievements, any of the transcendental states that are the subject here. And the seventh is the personal claim. So you have to make a claim about yourself personally achieving the state. If you're making a claim about someone else achieving that state, say for example, your teacher, your shifu, then that would not be considered a major violation. Now that would be a medium offense. And as we know, medium offenses can be repented. And the eighth is the clear and understandable speech. So you have to use clear language and understandable language to make the point to your object. And so if you're hinting at it without making it clear, to say you tell someone that one of your teacher's students has achieved the fourth jhana, and that student is in this room right now, and you're alluding to yourself, then that would not fulfill this factor, because hinting at it is not sufficient to satisfy it. You have to use very clear and identifiable speech indicating that you yourself have attained that state. And the ninth is the speech is clearly understood by the other. So that person has to understand very clearly what you're saying. You have to be speaking in a language that he understands. If you're using another language and he doesn't understand it, doesn't comprehend that particular language, then even though you've made all these claims and fulfilled all these factors, that would still not be a violation. So that covers the factors for transcendental false speech. And so I'd like to go into the other type of false speech, which is mundane false speech. Now, this is the type of speech that most of us are prone to committing. There isn't any serious offense here, like there is with transcendental false speech, but it's still very important that we refrain from committing these types of harmful speech, because we know that over time, even small offenses can accumulate, and they can easily turn into major offenses. Just like how small droplets of water over time can fill a great big vessel. So we have to really watch out and be mindful of the type of speech that we use. Otherwise, we could be creating a lot of negative karma that through repeated action can also lead to very serious consequences. So mundane speech comes in four categories. So the first is lying, meaningless or insincere speech, double-tongued speech, and malicious speech. Now, lying is knowing something and telling someone something else. So what you know is inconsistent with what you say. And the intention is to deceive or mislead the other person, usually for a selfish motive. So some of you might be wondering, what about white lies? Well-intentioned lies that are meant to benefit the other person. These are usually more trivial in nature. Say, for example, someone asked you whether you've eaten. You haven't eaten, but you know that if you say no, that person would go out of their way to make a meal for you. So if you say, yes, you have eaten, is that considered a violation? And the answer is no, because by telling that lie, not only are you not causing that person any harm, but you're actually giving that person peace of mind and comfort. So in those cases, that would not be a violation. And while we talk about this, I should also mention the other category of false speech in the first lie, which is convenient false speech. Now, convenient false speech is very similar to what I just talked about with white lies. In convenient false speech, you're telling a lie to bring well-being to a person or to help that person out of trouble. So, say you're in a forest and you see a deer run by. And then moments later, a hunter comes by and asks you whether you've seen a deer. And if you say that you haven't seen the deer, is that a violation? In this situation, if you know that the hunter has the intention of killing that deer, if you say you didn't see a deer, if you point him in the other direction that the deer went, that would not be a violation. And the reason is because you're telling that lie to protect that sentient being, to get that sentient being out of trouble. And so there wouldn't be any offense at all. If anything, there would be great merit associated with that act of compassion that you did in helping that sentient being out of trouble. So the second type of mundane false speech is meaningless or insincere speech. So using flowery language to flatter and to impress others, engaging in frivolous or meaningless talk, giving people empty praise. Now, we should know that this type of speech induces us into laziness, and it has the effect of leading other people to not take us seriously. So you'll find that those who always commit this type of speech may have a difficult time getting respect from people because what they say carries very little weight and credibility behind it. The third type of mundane speech is double-tongued speech. And double-tongued speech refers to saying one thing to one person and something else to another with the purpose of creating disharmony or separation between them. And when we talk about retributions, we'll know that committing this type of harmful speech will lead us to be in disharmony with our friends and our family, and may even lead to us becoming a victim of slander or gossip in our future lives. And finally, we have malicious speech. Malicious speech refers to any sort of cursing, so the using of foul language, slandering, mocking, belittling others. So when this type of speech is directed at someone, that person will feel hurt and will experience a lot of suffering. And there's mention in the Buddhist commentaries that the karma associated with malicious speech is especially strong in bringing about a lot of negative retributions, especially when we're committing malicious speech against the three jewels, so the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. So this is something that we should watch out for and make sure that we try our best to refrain from committing any type of malicious speech. Now, the factors for mundane speech are very similar, almost identical to transcendental false speech. The only two that are left out are the nature of speech, so it has to be about some spiritual achievement, and the personal claim, claiming that you yourself have obtained that state. All the other factors are the same, so I won't go into any detail about them again. So let's take a look at what are some of the exceptions. So again, like in the other precepts, if you're in a state of hysteria or mental confusion, and what is the standard that we use for being in a state of hysteria? Well, in the Buddhist commentary, it mentions that if you see excrement or feces, you reach for it like it's fragrant sandalwood. Or if you see fire, you reach for it like it's gold. That's the standard that's set in the Buddhist commentaries. And so if you're in a state where you've completely lost all control of your mental faculties, then committing false speech would not be an offense. If there's no intention to deceive or mislead, then that would also not be an offense. So say you were misinformed about something that you told to someone else, which ended up being untrue. You genuinely believe that what you said was true, even though it wasn't, then that would not be a violation. And the third is convenient false speech, which I just talked about. But we should know that for convenient false speech, it not only applies to helping beings in physical danger, but also to do with anything relating to harming that person's spiritual practice. So if you know that by saying something, it might obstruct that person's spiritual progress, or it might lose him, or it might cause him to lose confidence in the teachings, then if you withhold that information from him, that would not be considered false speech. So what are the consequences of failing to uphold this precept? Well, like in the other precepts, if a major offense is committed, like transcendental false speech, then you face the risk of falling into the three evil realms. And someone who habitually commits malicious speech against the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha also faces this risk of descending into the evil realms. Becoming a victim of slander. So you might notice that some people, even if they did not commit any wrongdoing, they always seem to be the victim of slander or gossip. And again, we should know that all karmic retributions are determined by causality. And so if you've committed slander against that person in the past, then naturally there's no way to escape others from doing the same to you in this life or in your future life. Easily deceived by others, that's another potential consequence. So you might encounter some people who might even be very good or kind-hearted, but for some reason they always get cheated or swindled by other people. And the reason for this is twofold. One, it's very likely that They did not uphold the precept of not stealing in their previous life. And two, it's very likely that they also did not uphold this precept well. So because they cheated and misled other people in the past, then by causality, they can't escape them from being victims of being cheated and swindled in their future life. And so what are the benefits? Rebirth in the human or heavenly realm up to enlightenment. So I won't go into any more detail about this because I've talked about this before, and it applies to every one of the precepts. The second is eloquent, articulate, and persuasive. So you might wonder why some people are very eloquent, articulate, and persuasive in their speech. They have the gift of gab. They have an ability to have a commanding presence as soon as they open their mouth and as soon as they talk. Well, the reason for that is because they've upheld this precept well in their previous lives. These people can be very persuasive. They can convince other people to do things for them. Their words can carry a lot of weight and power behind them. If you remember the story about the Arahat and the dragon, the Arahat taming the dragon when 500 Arahats combined with their supernatural powers cannot tame that dragon, you can see the power of upholding the precepts. Just using a few words to tame that dragon was enough. And the reason for that was because he had impeccably upheld this precept of abstaining from false speech. And finally, speaking without fault. This is related to the previous one. Sometimes when we speak, we may unintentionally or even intentionally say things that can cause harm to other people, or we might say things that other people don't like to hear. So committing all sorts of verbal blunders. This is a direct result of not upholding this precept well in our previous lives. So if we want to be eloquent, if we want to be articulate and persuasive, and we want to speak without any faults, then we have to uphold this precept. So before we head off for lunch, I'd like to cover this fifth and final precept. So the fifth precept is abstaining from taking alcohol and intoxicants. Now, as I mentioned before, if we violate any one of the first four precepts, they're fundamental offenses. So by its nature, even if you haven't taken that precept, it's a serious offense to violate it. It's very difficult to get away from the karmic retributions that come from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and false speech, unless you go through a very lengthy process of repentance. But the fifth precept is what we call a preventative precept. So there's no offense inherent in drinking alcohol, but it's the things that being intoxicated can lead you to do that makes it very dangerous. So I'd like to quickly share a story with you that just shows what kind of dangers are involved when you take alcohol. So there was once an upasaka. An upasaka is a lay Buddhist follower who has taken the five precepts. And this upasaka had upheld the precepts very well. But one day, the upasaka, he returned home from a long journey. And his family members had not come home yet. And so because he came back from a long journey, he was very thirsty, and he was desperately looking for something to drink. And so he saw a pot of what he thought to be water on his dinner table. And so he took it, and he hastily gulped it down. Now, it turned out that that pot did not contain water, but was actually alcohol. So not long after, when the alcohol started to kick in, this upasaka became fully intoxicated. And it was during this time that one of his neighbor's chickens ended up finding its way into his home. And so the Upasaka, who was completely drunk at the time, he saw this chicken and he decided to slaughter it for his dinner. Then, shortly after, when he was still very heavily intoxicated, his neighbor's wife came knocking on his door to see if he had seen her missing chicken. And he responded by saying no, and as the neighbor's wife turned around to leave, the Upasaka, noticing how beautiful and attractive she was, out of strong lust and desire, took her into his home and raped her. And so when this case was brought to the courts and it was questioned by the judge, he denied that he had done any of these things. But to no avail, the Upasaka ended up receiving his retribution for committing these wrongful acts. So we can see that taking alcohol or any intoxicant can potentially be very dangerous, and it can lead us to violate and commit a lot of wrongdoings. And so in this case, the Upasaka, he ended up violating each of the four major precepts. So he stole his neighbor's chicken, he killed it for his food, he committed sexual misconduct against his neighbor's wife, and he committed false speech when he was tried by the judge. So there's a very good reason why the Buddha formulated this precept. Even though drinking is not an inherent act of wrongfulness by itself, when we're intoxicated, it can lead us to commit all sorts of wrongdoing. And so that's why the Buddha formulated it as one of the five major precepts. Quickly go over the definition. Anything that has a look, smell, or taste of alcohol, and if consumed will lead to intoxication and drunkenness. Now, that's one of the standard definitions used in Buddhist literature. But we should also know that other than alcohol, any type of intoxicant, like drugs or narcotics, if used other than for medical reasons, would also fall under this precept. Really, any substance that causes your mind to be intoxicated and leads you to do things that you normally would not do, that would fall under this category. Now, I should also mention that selling or serving alcohol, while it's not explicitly stated in the wording of the precept, it should also be included. Because if you've looked into the Bodhisattva precepts, you'll learn that selling or serving alcohol is actually a much more serious offense than drinking alcohol for yourself. Because one who has taken the Bodhisattva precepts has taken a vow to help all sentient beings and to relieve them of their sufferings. And so by serving or selling them alcohol, you're encouraging and facilitating them to commit wrongdoing. So we should abstain from getting involved in any sort of business or activity that makes or serves alcohol to other people. So opening bars, restaurants that serve alcohol, or putting together parties where you serve alcohol to others. And so the three factors are, the first is object, so it has to be an alcohol or an intoxicant. The second is perception of the object. That object has to be perceived as alcohol or intoxicant. So if you perceive it to be something else, for example, like water, but it ends up being alcohol, then in that case, the first sip is not an offense. But any additional sip after that would be considered an offense. The third and final one is ingestion. So once the alcohol is ingested down the throat, then that would be deemed as fulfilling this factor. If the alcohol is still in your mouth, it hasn't passed down through the throat yet, and you spit it out, then that would not be an offense. And we have a few exceptions. Not knowing or without intention, just like every other precept. Using alcohol for cooking, Sometimes we like to use alcohol to bring out the flavors of the ingredients that we're cooking. And because when you cook it, when you apply heat to it, the alcoholic content usually evaporates, so that would not be considered a violation. Using alcohol as medicine, so there are two conditions for this. The first is it has to be a very serious sickness. And the second is there's no other option. There's no other replacement that you can use other than alcohol. The fourth is using alcohol to disinfect or clean a wound. So applying alcohol to your skin, that would not be a violation because you're not ingesting it. You're not fulfilling that third factor. And so that covers the fifth and final precept. So just to wrap up, we spent the last six talks introducing the topic of Buddhist morality and going through each of the five precepts. And I've tried to cover all the most important points of each precept. But really, all I've done is give you a very general overview of what each of the precepts are. So I encourage all of you, especially those who have already taken the precepts, to continue to study and review these precepts from time to time. Because upholding the precepts well is not something that we can do at the get-go. It takes a lot of diligent effort and training. In the beginning, when you start to uphold these precepts, you might encounter some discomfort or resistance. But if anything, that's a good sign, because it means that you're going against and you're fighting those mental defilements within you that have been running wildly since time without beginning, because you've been habitually been conditioned by all these negative emotions of desire, hatred, and ignorance. And so you might encounter some resistance, but that's actually a good sign, because it means that you're fighting the defilements that lead to your suffering and to rebirth in samsara. And over time, you'll notice that with diligent practice, you'll notice a transformation within you. That gatekeeper within you will be getting stronger day by day, preventing you from committing wrongdoing and motivating you to uphold goodness. If we really want to start finding happiness and peace of mind in our life, then it starts with upholding the precepts. Because we know from the law of causality that the practice of goodness is what leads to happiness. If we can do that, then that's when we can really begin to find some peace and peace of mind and happiness in our lives. So that wraps this series up. And if any of you have any feedback or any other topics you'd be interested in hearing in the future, please let me know. And we'll see when the next opportunity arises for that.